News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Bird, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we are replaying from the morning show archives a memorable interview with Lewis Sorley talking about his book about the Vietnam War. We are replaying some of these interviews related to the Vietnam War because of the Ken Burns documentary series currently airing on PBS. I have been greedily devouring a remarkable book called A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam, written by Lewis Sorley, a third-generation graduate of West Point, holding a doctorate from Johns Hopkins University. He has served in the U.S. Army, has been on the staff at the Pentagon, and actually also a senior civilian official of the Central Intelligence Agency. So he brings all of that varied experience and expertise to bear in writing this fascinating book, which, among many things, especially tells the story of an extraordinary American, General Creighton Abrams. And he is certainly a figure who is unjustly neglected. And we come to really appreciate his greatness as a military leader and human being, for that matter, in the pages of this book. And actually, Lewis Sorley has written about him before in a couple of previous books. This book then would be, in a sense, a more comprehensive look at the crucial final years of the Vietnam War, really dating from essentially the year 1968 and forward. And when one looks at the books that have been written about the Vietnam War, there is a strange void. That is, this aspect of the Vietnam War has not been studied and written about and examined to the extent that it really deserves to be. And particularly, of course, in light of current conflicts, which have certain rather ominous echoes of the Vietnam conflict and the unsatisfying conclusion to that conflict, as we wrestle with certain questions now, it is all the more important that we understand what went right and what went wrong with our conduct of the Vietnam War. We see that examined in fascinating fashion in this book called A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. This is a Harvest book from Harcourt. It is now available in paperback. And Lewis Sorley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, sir.
So essentially, you are trying to help us more carefully examine this particular facet of the Vietnam War. I wonder if you could first of all expand on something which you talk about in the prologue of your book, and that is, if you pile up a stack of books about the Vietnam War, and of course scores of them have been written, how little we find which examines these final years of the conflict. First of all, to what extent is that true, and why in the world would that be the case?
It is true to a great extent. I appreciate your highlighting this because some people have commented about A Better War, that is, they've called it revisionist history. And I've said, no, it's not revisionist history because that period has not been adequately looked at all. It's new history. And the reason for that is that all the better-known books about the war in Vietnam, Stanley Carnow's books, well-known, Neil Sheehan's book, A Bright Shining Lie, very well known. George Herring, a professor, has probably got the best-known academic treatment of the war. And all of those books, and many others as well, concentrate almost entirely on the period of the war up through the Tet Offensive of early 1968, and only give glancing attention to the period from that that state through the end of the war, but which was seven more years, and included the period when General Abrams, whom we've referred to, commanded American forces in Vietnam. Sheehan's book is the most startling. In a book of 790 pages, he devotes 65 pages to the whole rest of the war. That amounts to 88% of his book, even though John Paul Vann, the nominal subject of his book, lived and worked in Vietnam for four more years after Tet 68. So if we're going to look back to the Vietnam War for lessons learned and try to apply those in any future conflicts and places, it seems to me extremely important that we understand the true lessons of the Vietnam War. Otherwise, we're going to be grossly misled, and that could lead to further tragedies.
Hmm. I am curious about why this neglect might be in place. And it's interesting, as you describe in particular the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Bright Shining Lie, one almost gets the image of an author being sort of exhausted by the end of the project, and thus giving short shrift to the final years of the conflict, which would be in a sense kind of a curious parallel to what some might say is kind of what happened with America's involvement as well. That at some point we just kind of got worn out by the conflict. I suspect, though, the reason for historians neglecting the end of the Vietnam War surely is more complicated than that.
I think that you have certainly articulated a part of the rationale or the motivation, and you're right. There are, I think, several different things that came into play here. One is, I'm now working on a biography of General William C. Westmoreland, who commanded American forces in the earlier part of the war and was succeeded by Abrams after the Tet 68 offensive. And General Westmoreland focused almost entirely on combat operations. He decided to fight a war of attrition. When I say he decided to, he was free to make that choice, and he says that he did that in his autobiography. And in such a war, his objective was to kill as many of the enemy as possible on the premise that eventually they would lose heart and cease their aggression against the South. And so he did, in fact, kill an enormous number of the enemy, but it did not have the postulated outcome. They just sent more and more forces down to the South and sacrificed them and had plenty of forces to do that and showed no inclination to cease doing so. And in the meantime, he was neglecting two other very important tasks. One was to upgrade South Vietnam's armed forces so they could progressively take over more of the responsibility for security of their own country. And even more important, he was failing to root out the covert infrastructure that the enemy had built in the hamlets and villages of rural South Vietnam. And that those forces were using terror and coercion to keep the populace under enemy domination. And the big battles out in the deep jungle were having no effect whatever on that. So that could have gone on forever. And you're right, I think that exhausted a lot of the goodwill and support of certainly the American people, of the Congress, and even the media in those earlier years. And I will probably say in the Westmoreland biography, and I'll acknowledge that this is a harsh judgment, but I will probably say that General Westmoreland squandered 4 years of support from the public and the Congress and largely from the media.
Hmm. So your book, in large measure, is about the leadership of General Creighton W. Abrams and two other important people who form a significant triumvirate, Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker and Ambassador William Colby. And we see in them, in their leadership, a new notion of how this war should be waged, which I believe is termed by General Abrams total war. And that would be a term I think very easily misunderstood by the public. Can you say a word about what General Abrams meant by total war and draw a contrast to what you just described with General Westmoreland's approach to Vietnam?
Yes, and I'm very glad that you mentioned Ambassador Bunker and Ambassador Colby, because it was the shared view of the nature of the war and as a consequence of how it should be prosecuted to be successful. Of those three men, remarkable public servants in my view, men of intelligence, of decency, of personal modesty, and of absolute determination to bring about a positive outcome in Vietnam. Ambassador Bunker served for 6 years in his 70s at the head of our embassy in Saigon, and Ambassador Colby was there for 3 years, put our support for the pacification program into shape and made it very effective, and of course General Abrams was conducting the military operations. The term they usually used was one war. They called it one war, and that meant a war, yes, of combat operations. They realized you had to continue those, but much changed in their period of time. And along with that, the two other things I mentioned having been neglected in the earlier period, building up South Vietnam's armed forces and rooting out the communist infrastructure. And those their contention was that if you neglected any one of those key aspects of the war, you could not succeed. And so they went about trying to advance on all those fronts and were quite successful in doing so.
Hmm. And, of course, they are talking about an undertaking which, as you say, extends far beyond standard military strategy and procedure. In fact, it's so interesting. You quote General Abrams at a number of different points in talking about what is required for this task and certain facets of this task, that we will see him using terms like sensitivity in terms of working with the public, in terms of assisting and advising some of the Vietnamese in their own military structure and political government and so on. Terms like sensitivity, that was one of the things most necessary in bringing about this one war approach to successful fruition.
That's absolutely correct. At one point, General Abrams, very frustrated, says, "My problem is colored blue." And by that he meant he had a problem with his own forces and those of the South Vietnamese. As you know, blue is a color usually used on battle maps to portray friendly forces as compared to red used for enemy forces. My problem is colored blue, and he insisted that the excessive use of firepower, as he viewed it, that was causing unwanted casualties amongst the civil population, be reined in. And that was certainly a sensitive approach, but it was also an essential one, because the people in the hamlets and the villages made no distinction between whose bomb it was that fell on them or whose artillery round it was that killed or damaged the people where they were. And he was quite successful in this, in that. In the earlier part of the war, the Westmoreland years that I've described, the measure of merit was body count, and I've explained why that was. Abrams said often, you know, body count doesn't have much to do with the outcome of this war. And once he went so far as to tell a group of ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors from Southeast Asia, you know, in the whole sweep of this war, the battles don't really mean very much. Well, I suggest that's the other end of the spectrum from somebody who is fighting a war of attrition, focused in almost entirely on the piling up of body counts.
He really called the body count irrelevant.
He did. And in his period, the measure of merit was population secured.
Hmm. So when we look at this triumvirate, then, this is how you describe it in the chapter called Inheritance. These new arrivals, that is, these three new leaders, shared an outlook on conduct of the war, an outlook much different from Westmoreland's. My question is, was that a fortunate coincidence? Or otherwise, how did this triumvirate happen to take shape and all embracing the same vision of how the war in Vietnam should be waged by the United States?
That's a great question, and the partial answer, but I think a large part of the answer, goes back to 1965, when we begin to introduce large numbers of American ground forces into the war, beginning in the spring and then in large numbers in the summer. A big difference between the Westmoreland years, the earlier years, and the later years under Abrams is that General Westmoreland's response to every crisis is to ask for more forces, and for a long time he gets them. And so during his tenure, we're continuing to build up the forces in Vietnam. When Abrams takes command, soon after he takes command, the administration changes. President Nixon succeeds President Johnson. And during that entire period, we are progressively withdrawing our forces from South Vietnam. So there's a paradox. We have fewer forces and we're doing better. And the reason we're doing better, I'm absolutely certain, is a different conception of what it takes to win that war. And it goes back to the same time we started introducing the forces. General Harold K. Johnson, about whom I've also written a book called Honorable Warrior, was the chief of staff of the Army. And his vice chief of staff for the first three of his 4 years in office was Creighton Abrams. And General Johnson cranked up a study called PROVEN. I think that's an acronym for pacification and long-term development of South Vietnam. And he had about 12 people on this study group, colonels, lieutenant colonels, I think one major, a very wide range of talents. They worked on the study from the summer of 65 until it was published in March of 66. And this study said, in brief compass, the way General Westmoreland is going about fighting the war is not working and cannot work. And the reason it can't work is because it's ignoring the locus of the battle, which is the people and control of the people and protection of the people in South Vietnam, in the hamlets and, you know, the rural population that I've already mentioned.
You state at one point that object in this war needs to be not destruction,
yes,
but control.
Exactly. And, of course, the more destruction you wreak on the civilian populace, the more you alienate them when you're trying to get them to be supportive of their own government and be better able to take control of their own affairs. So the PROVEN study, I think, was the start of it. After 3 years as Vice Chief of Staff, Abrams was then sent out to Vietnam. I'm confident that General Harold K. Johnson was responsible for that, and he became the deputy to Westmoreland. Abrams believed that he would take over within a matter of a few weeks, and in fact, he was allowed to choose his own chief of staff and take that officer with him. But for a variety of reasons, that didn't happen for 13 months, which was fateful, because in that period of time, General Westmoreland is coming back to the United States, speaking to a joint session of Congress, speaking at the National Press Club, and saying very positive, optimistic things. And then at the end of January, Americans see on their television screens the Tet Offensive breaking out all over South Vietnam, and they conclude one of two things. Either General Westmoreland didn't know what he was talking about, or he wasn't leveling with us. And I don't know which is the more devastating critique, but Abrams would never have done that.
Hmm.
So I have to just add this one more thing. You ask how these three men came to see it the same way. Colby came out to be the pacification chief. Abrams had run off a man named Robert Comer, a blowhard who was all talk and no action. And then Ambassador Bunker had been there from about the same time, 2 months earlier than Abrams came out as a deputy. So they had gotten to know each other very well by this time. And they shared the qualities that I've described before, and I think it was a natural thing that they would then conclude jointly how to go about the prosecution of the war.
Hmm. What's intriguing is that this concept of one war was, in the words of Lieutenant General Julian Ewell, was the one war concept was, like most powerful ideas, very simple. But you go on, or like most ideas in Vietnam, it was rather difficult in execution. And there were all kinds of ways in which it was a difficult thing to
yes.
implement. I want to read the final paragraph of Chapter 2 as you describe General Abrams taking control. You say, in due course, Abrams changed what he could, everything he could. He inherited an awkward chain of command, lack of unified operational control over South Vietnamese and other allied forces, an elaborate and wasteful base camp system, an exposed string of static border camps, severe geographical and procedural restrictions on conduct of the war, greatly diminished domestic support. These he had to live with. The rest he changed. I mean, when one considers that list of potential obstacles, that he was able to accomplish much of anything is impressive indeed.
Well, and I appreciate your reading that passage, because my perspective is that a lesser man would have just lost heart and given up. And Abrams was there for 5 years straight. You know, we're talking about World War II. If you went in on the Normandy beaches in June of 1944, your war was over 11 months later in May of 45, even if you went through the whole thing. And he's there for 5 years. And during that time, the people who are under him, including most of the generals that are under him, come and go. And he becomes the institutional memory. And he has to teach them over and over again that the way to fight the war that he wants to fight. Because, you know, obviously, if you're a military guy, your conclusion is if you go to war, the biggest thing to do is go out and find the enemy and do him in. And of course, the press pretty much saw it that way, too. So trying to convince these people that the pacification and security for the people in the hamlets and helping them get their goods to market and showcasing the government and helping it be more effective and bringing in miracle rice and currency reform and land to the tiller, which gave the tenant farmers a title to their own land, and a host of other things that most people wouldn't think of as military, were key aspects of succeeding in that complicated war in Vietnam.
We're speaking with Lewis Sorley. We're talking about his book, A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. One of my favorite moments in the book is when you describe a moment in one of Abrams' first meetings, one of his first briefings in Vietnam, where somebody gets up to begin their presentation saying, "General, I've got some good news." And you say, "General Abrams put his hand up, stopping the man right there. "Gentlemen," he said, "we'll have the first change in the procedures of these meetings. From now on, we'll take up the bad news first. Then if there is any time left, we'll take up the good news."
Yes.
That's extraordinary. And, you know, that, I mean, that the implications of that ring far beyond the hallways of the Pentagon or where military matters and decisions are made. I mean, that is a powerful lesson for anyone in government or business or education. In just about any human undertaking, there is much to learn from General Abrams on this point.
Yes, you're right about that, and it's largely the reason, I think, besides his professional competence, which was apparent to all, that he had such credibility. He sent out a message even before he'd taken formal command. General Westmoreland was on a round of farewell calls, and Abrams was, in effect, a de facto commander. He sent out a message, and he said, "Actions, not predictions, will be our measure now." And one time, he got a message from the senior Vietnamese general who was commanding up in the northern provinces of American forces, who complained that there was too much on Armed Forces Radio, the GI radio network, about protests and so on back in the United States. Abrams went, called in the editors from the thing, and he talked with them about it. He sent a message back to the Marine, and he said, I'm confident that the coverage that is being provided in Armed Forces Network is accurate and appropriate. And he said, our job is to persevere in the face of the realities. And he refused to censor that network. I thought that was another very important thing for him to do.
Hmm. Another really interesting image, and again, this would seem to be in sharp contrast to perhaps maybe the style of General Westmoreland and so on, is you have him saying to a visiting officer, "We devote Saturdays to wrestling with this thing, some particular intelligence matter, we try generally to have one or two things that have been done in depth over a period of time, trying to challenge what we think.
Yes.
The picture you give us there is of someone who is intellectually very curious and inquisitive, and not willing to just rest on the tried and true practices of the past, and that he was not going to allow any of his officers to be sort of intellectually, mentally complacent as well.
I think that's exactly right. I had a good talk once with Douglas Pike, who was a very well-known Foreign Service officer who served in the embassy in Saigon when General Abrams was commanding, and later established an Indochina archive that's a very, very important research facility. Dr. Pike told me that Abrams would, from time to time, ask him to come over. And he said, I've never had an encounter with a senior general officer like the ones with him. He said he didn't ask me for a briefing. We just sat and talked. And he said, well, what are you working on now? And he was working on the Politburo in North Vietnam and what they might be doing and so on. And he said it was very refreshing. He was intellectually curious. He was open to my interpretation. But he had questions, and we discussed it. And he said, I always went back from those experiences just buoyed up to do my job better and be ready for the next time he might ask me to call.
Hmm. Abrams would tell his field commanders over and over again, we must work against the whole system.
Yes.
You say Ambassador Charlie Whitehouse recalled it well. Abe was constantly trying to get people to understand the enemy system. He must have preached that sermon 50 times, week after week, month after month, up and down the country. What is meant by the enemy system? And in what way was it otherwise not being paid attention to the way General Abrams felt it needed to be?
The enemy operated in ways that he identified. One of the key aspects of the answer to your question is what General Abrams came to call the enemy's logistics nose. In normal warfare, as you know, the military forces are trailed by their logisticals and other support mechanisms, so they call that the logistics tail. And Abrams said, well, the Vietnamese can't do that because they don't have the transport, and they don't have the transportation network and so on. They have to pre-position their supplies. In other words, put them out in front of them and then move the forces in at the last minute. And so he called that a logistics nose because they're putting it out in front. So one of the key things that he tasked his commanders with then was to find these pre-positioned supplies and preempt enemy attacks by scarfing these up. And then they'd have to, you know, go through that process all over again and so on. And even if you didn't head off the attack, you would lessen its effectiveness by taking away a good bit of the wherewithal. But there were many other aspects of the enemy system, including his means of replacing lost personnel. And he had only two ways to do that. He could infiltrate from the north, which he did in large numbers, or he could try to recruit in the south or impress people in the south, meaning recruit by force. So how the enemy resupplied his people was another aspect of that. The way in which he determined when and where he was going to conduct offensives was another of that. And Abrams was a very positive on the importance and the essentiality of intelligence, good, actionable intelligence, so that he could mount effective counteroffensives. Those are some of the aspects. And I think he had about seven or eight different parts of the enemy's operations that he felt should and could be targeted.
One thing that's intriguing to me, this is, I suppose, in some respects, slightly beside the point, but I want to be sure I ask you. I'm intrigued by how often you in the book and certain military figures that you quote in the book refer to the enemy as he. And it's probably sort of speaks to the mindset of someone who is confronting an enemy, but to almost always refer to the enemy as he, even when we're talking about the entire military structure of North Vietnam, referring to all of that as he, I find really, really intriguing, and wonder if that is something unique to the Vietnam conflict, or if that is commonly the way the enemy is referred to by military personnel.
Well, that's an excellent question. I really wasn't aware of having done that as you describe it. I'm sure you're right about that. I will say this. General Abrams had a lot of respect for the enemy. And that was particularly true when we're talking about the uniformed enemy. He did not have respect for the civilian communist Politburo leadership, because they were the ones who were directing a war in which the population was targeted indiscriminately by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, just as military forces were. And thus you had the rocketing of cities, and you had the taking of bombs into marketplaces to blow things up and so on, similar to what we're seeing today in some of the conflicts that we're involved in. But I think that he did respect the endurance of the enemy soldiers, their willingness to sacrifice. He found it horrifying that they would sacrifice such large numbers of forces for so little military gain. We now know, of course, that they were getting considerable political gain from doing so, and so you'd have to say, to that extent, they knew what they were doing. But General Abrams never denigrated the enemy soldier, and he did respect the soldiers and their battlefield leadership. So maybe that's where the he comes from. I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm. One of the important matters is something called interdiction, which is actually a term that was completely unknown to me before reading your book. And I suspect to the typical civilian reading your book, that's going to be a term that they'll be learning for the first time. Can you explain what interdiction is and how crucial it was to our efforts in Vietnam, and particularly the way in which General Abrams approached this matter?
Interdiction, as you now know from reading the book, means really to interfere with the enemy's activities, in this case primarily the movement of men and materiel down what was called the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a complex of trails really that ran from North Vietnam down through Laos and Cambodia along the western borders of South Vietnam and then branched off into South Vietnam. That was one of two main avenues of resupply for the enemy, the other being through the port of Sihanoukville of Cambodia and bring it up from the south, so the southern part of South Vietnam could get the supplies that way. It was a very difficult task to interdict the movement of men and materiel along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, largely because, first of all, we're prohibited from taking ground forces into the area where the trail was. That was a unilateral decision by the United States to respect the so-called neutrality of Laos and Cambodia, which was a fiction. But so you could bomb there, but you couldn't take forces in there to cut the trail. It was fortuitous that just about the time General Abrams took command, a wonderful new source of intelligence became available. And what it was the intercept of radio communications between one of the way stations on the Ho Chi Minh Trail and one of the controlling stations for that. And they were, our interceptors were able to pick up these messages, and they would talk about the so-called infiltration groups coming down the trail. These groups varied in size, but there were around 585 men or something like that. And they'd have a four-digit number. And the number would be 4012 or 4016 or so. And sometimes they began with three, sometimes two, sometimes one. And our interceptors figured out that the first number told you where they were going. If it was four, maybe they were going to the demilitarized zone. If it was two, they might be going to the Central Highlands. If it was three, they might be going down west of Saigon. And over time, they figured out how long it would take to go from North Vietnam to wherever the destination was. And so we knew when they left, where they were going, how long they were on the trail, and this permitted, as Abrams said, this permitted the Allies to prepare a proper reception.
Mm-hmm. There is progress that General Abrams makes in this matter and in other matters as well. But it is difficult to attain these breakthroughs, and it would seem that what proves to be even more difficult is for this kind of progress to be conveyed to the American public. You have some strong things to say about the politicians of this era and about the press in this era, in terms of their failure to grasp some of the new direction that was occurring at this point in the conflict, as though they could not wrest themselves away from earlier missteps. They just could not see any of this progress. I wonder, as you examine this, if some of the responsibility for that needs to rest with General Abrams. That is, to whatever extent it was important to have the support of politicians and the public back home, mm-hmm. that somehow this message needed to be conveyed. Was it just not possible, or are there other ways in which that did not happen in ways that it should have?
That's a very good question and a very troubling one, and I've thought about it a lot. I think that, like most of the things that you and I have been talking about this morning, there are multiple factors at work. Let's take the press briefly first. I say at some point that in the latter years, the press missed the war. They missed the story. What I mean by that is that they still continued to focus on the battles. Of course, the battles are still going on, and they're still important, but they're far from the whole story, as I'm sure our conversation thus far has made clear. And the press didn't really report the pacification program at all. It had little to say about the South Vietnamese armed forces and how they were getting stronger and better. In the earlier period of General Westmoreland's command, search and destroy was the tactical approach. And in Abrams' period, it was clear and hold. And the hold was provided by South Vietnam's so-called territorial forces that were staying in their home areas, protecting their families, their friends, their homes, their ancestral grave sites, and things that mattered to them very greatly. And also, they were being greatly improved in their training and especially in their equipment. In the early years, General Westmoreland had pretty much hogged all the good military equipment, including the famous M16 rifle, for the American forces. And the poor Vietnamese were fighting the enemy and usually outgunned because the enemy had the AK-47, another great weapon provided by the communist backers of North Vietnam. Abrams changed that immediately. He gave first priority not only to the South Vietnamese, but to these territorial forces. And so the hold then became a reality. But the press really never saw much of that and certainly didn't have much to say about it. I reached the conclusion that President Nixon never really fully understood how well things were going on his watch, and as a consequence, he was perhaps less demanding in the negotiations with the North Vietnamese, for example. But what really pulled the whole thing down is that eventually people who opposed the war were elected in the 1974 election to the Congress of the United States and joined with anti-war forces already there and very strong. And the Congress basically said, we've had enough of this. And they drastically cut the support to the South Vietnamese to the extent that when the enemy mounted its final offensive, we were all gone, as we talked about. The South Vietnamese couldn't sustain themselves because they lacked the wherewithal. Neither North or South Vietnam was in any way self-sustaining or self-sufficient in military wherewithal. But the North Vietnamese got greatly increased backing from their patrons. Hmm. So those are some of the things that happened. But the point you asked about, could General Abrams have done more to make it clear that things were going better, not only better but much better? I don't know. Perhaps you're right about that. Perhaps he should have. But the forum he had was frequent visits to Vietnam by people like Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was first General Earl Wheeler and then Admiral Tom Moore, the Commander-in-Chief Pacific, who would come over from Hawaii, and various visitors, including lots of members of Congress and so on. And Abrams would speak very candidly to them. He'd tell them the things that were going well. He'd tell them the problems that he still had. And of course, he's progressively sending his troops home. So I think there were plenty of opportunities for him to express his assessment of the situation, and that he did so. But those were largely to, what would we call it, an internal audience, maybe. And then it would be perhaps up to them to address the larger audience, the public, the Congress, and so on.
Right. One of your most interesting observations, it's actually General Abrams' observation, is that he said, if you want to find some traditionalists, just look at the press. That the press had this fascination as though all of them had grown up on the film Patton, which was just out. But I mean that for them, that's what war was. That's all that war was.
Yeah.
And of course, this idea of one war is, in some respects, relatively unfamiliar. I mean, it's probably not fair to expect that they should have understood all of that on their own. But too many people were caught up in a sense, outmoded models of what war is about. This needed to be a different kind of war, and it was not enough for General Abrams and his inner circle to understand that. There were consequences in that not being properly understood by more people.
You're right, and that's the kind of war that we've found ourselves engaged in since that time. And so if there are lessons to be learned from a proper understanding of what happened in Vietnam and why, that's probably the realm in which they lie.
Hmm. You write, Abrams had taken command in Vietnam only a few months after America had decided, in the wake of the Tet Offensive, that the war should be abandoned as unwinnable and not worth pursuing. And that, of course, leads to the gradual withdrawal of troops. I think this was, in many respects, the single most fascinating part of your book, because you point out some very interesting ways in which the withdrawal of troops was done in such a way that was tremendously counterproductive. And General Abrams and General Westmoreland had two very different ideas about how the drawdown should occur. Describe that disagreement and how ultimately the withdrawal occurred, and how, at least in General Abrams' view, it was very detrimental to his efforts.
Well, that is an absolutely key aspect of the latter years of the war. It made General Abrams' job much more difficult. It made the job of almost every commander much more difficult. The issue was this. The president would say, all right, by a given date, we're going to take out X number of troops. The first ones came out in July and August of 1969, President Nixon had come into office in January, 25,000 troops there, and then another 40,000 troops later that year, October, November, maybe December. And so Abrams would make up a troop list. You know, here's what, okay, you want those many out, this is what we're going to take out. And he wanted to take them out by units. In other words, okay, we're going to take out the 3rd Marine Division, let us say. And General Westmoreland said, no. If you do that, you'll have some people who have been coming out who have only been there a short time because they only went as replacements 3 months ago or whatever it is. And he says, that's not fair. What you have to do is take out the soldiers who have been there the longest. And they had a terrible battle about this, but Westmoreland won because by then he's the Army Chief of Staff and he can actually decide. And so Abrams is obliged to do that. What that meant then was you send home the flag of the 3rd Marine Division, but you put into it all the longest-serving Marines that you have over there and take out of that division people who have recently arrived and disperse them into the other units from which you've taken the longer-serving ones, and everything is in chaos. The people who are on the battlefield together now, they don't know each other. They've just all been scrambled. People are taking units into battle that they don't really know. The cohesion of units, which is, as you know, is extremely important to battlefield success, has largely been destroyed, and there's just no question but that a lot of the later problems of indiscipline and even racial hatreds and drug abuse and so on that became in the very end of the war extremely difficult were to a degree a result of that decision. It had the consequences were enormous and unnecessary. That issue of fairness was inconsequential compared to the effects of the decision.
What rings so loudly as we read about General Abrams, as much as anything, is his devotion to honesty and to truth. Yeah. The fact that so often there would be those in positions of leadership who would gravitate towards what at one point someone describes as illusory progress. I mean, progress that's just an illusion, mm-hmm. or engaging in endless games of kidding themselves. Clearly, General Abrams believed in something else, and believed that as much as anything, if you're going to truly be successful in any kind of difficult endeavor, one has to be honest with oneself and with others. And this would seem to be one of the most striking contrasts between General Abrams and those that preceded him.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I'll just mention two instances which support what you just said. I mentioned earlier that General Abrams had been there 5 years by the time he came back in the summer of 72 to become the Army Chief of Staff. He'd been the deputy for a year and then 4 years in command. And on the last night that he's there, they have a little going-away dinner for him in the command mess. And he says to the senior officers who were with him there, he says, "The longer I serve, the more I become convinced that the single most important attribute of the professional officer is integrity." And General Abrams died after only 2 years as Army Chief of Staff, a great shock to the Army. And he was leading the Army back, reforming the problems that had occurred during Vietnam. They put a monument up for him at the Army War College at Carlisle Barracks in Pennsylvania. It's just a piece of rock, really, and I'll read you what's on that monument because it's a saying, it's a quotation of General Abrams himself. It's short. He said, "There must be within our Army a sense of purpose and a dedication to that purpose. There must be a willingness to march a little farther, to carry a heavier load, to step out into the darkness and the unknown for the safety and well-being of others." And I think that describes him and the leadership example that he set quite well. General Abrams had some other people begin to call them sayings, and he would use these to make a point and sometimes use them over and over again. One of his sayings was, "People are not in the Army, people are the Army." And the one I think was perhaps his favorite because of the times and ways in which he used it, "Soldiering is an affair of the heart." Now, I'm a third-generation soldier myself and very proud of my grandfather and my father who preceded me, and I will say that means a lot to me. Hmm.
The book is A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam, a paperback from Harcourt, the author Lewis Sorley. Lewis Sorley, I do thank you so much for writing this remarkable and important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you. It's been my great pleasure.
Lewis Sorley was generous enough to agree to a second interview about this book called A Better War. And we will share that second interview in which we further explore some of these issues next week on The Morning Show. Tomorrow I'll be speaking with Barbara Batten, who is director of the Kenosha Public Library. And on Wednesday you'll hear my interview with Martha Brokenbrough, author of Alexander Hamilton, Revolutionary. Thursday, sports writer Mike Lupica and also Eduardo Garcia Novelli from Carthage College talks about the 90th anniversary of the Carthage Choir, which is going to be commemorated.